This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for the return of an iconic stage drama, a unique look at a smash Broadway hit, or conversation with the wife of a jazz legend, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. A groundbreaking family drama, now an American classic, is celebrating a major milestone. A Raisin in the Sun will return to the stage on the 60th anniversary of Lorraine Hansberry's play. It is presented by Voices in the Dark Repertory Theater Company and Ashe Cultural Arts Center. Director Tommy Myrick and actors Michael Forrest and Constance Thompson are here. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thank you.
This was groundbreaking work on many levels. Take us back to 1959, Tommy. What was happening in the country, and how did a play by an African-American woman about an African-American family seeking the American dream find its way on Broadway at that time?
You know, I'm so glad you asked that question, because in 1959, we are living through a civil rights movement, Emmett Till, Rosa Parks, and Martin Luther King. And for a young woman, 28 years old, Lorraine Hansberry, to write a play like this and then get it cast on Broadway was phenomenal. We're still living in a segregated South. We're still fighting for rights. African-American soldiers are returning home from the Korean War. And though they may have fought in World War II and the Korean War, they still are not allowed to vote in many counties and states. They still are not allowed to sit where they want to sit. And so we're still living in a time where we are trying very, very hard to be a part of a society that we have fought and died for.
And how did she break through?
Lorraine Hansberry broke through because she was a pioneer. She was a young woman of privilege means. Her father owned many housing complexes and apartments in Chicago. That's where she grew up. And she just decided that even though they wanted her to go to college, she was morally socially conscious of what was happening in America, much to her father's chagrin. But she decided that she wanted to go to New York, and there is where she got her start, being a part of the movement that was happening then. And there was a movement, and that movement is more of a Pan-African movement, who we are as an African people. And so all of this is embraced by Lorraine Hansberry in this one play. A Raisin in the Sun is the African-American version of reaching for the American dream, but not able to accomplish it, not just because of your socioeconomic means, but because of your racial origin. And there lies the rub, as Shakespeare would say.
She was inspired by the times and also a poem by Langston Hughes,
who wrote, "What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run?" And then as it goes on, it ends up by saying, "Or does it just explode?" And I think what Lorraine Hansberry has done is put all the variables that are encompassed within the African-American community into one play, one raisin, and let it explode.
So let's set the stage.
In 1959, a south side of Chicago, a tenement building of which Lena Younger and her husband, Walter Lee Younger Sr., lived in for well over 35 years, where the bathrooms are still shared by everyone on that floor. But in that household, it's three generations. It's Lena, it's her son and his wife, Ruth, and their son, Travis. And shortly after the death of her husband, Walter Lee Younger Sr., there is an insurance check of $10,000, which brings us to how the story begins to unfold in terms of what to do with that $10,000, how to make everyone's dream a reality. They all are looking to save their family from poverty.
Let's talk more about the characters. We have Michael Forrest. This is a debut for you. You play Walter Lee Jr.?
Yes, ma'am, I do.
And Constance Thompson?
Yes.
You play Michael's wife, Ruth. Tell us about your characters and what you bring to the roles.
Walter is not angry. He's in pain. Because of his frustration and the way he feels about life and his outlook about many things, he wants someone to understand him so badly that he gets worked up easily. His range of emotions comes from a much deeper place, his desire to take care of his family and provide.
And Ruth, as his wife, sees her husband, who works very hard. All of the people in the house work extremely hard. And she sees a man who has big, big dreams, but sometimes wants to get things in a short, quick manner. She's used to getting and accomplishing things for her family through persistent dedication and determination, and he's tired of that. And so I'm here to gently tell him, as his wife, I'm with him, but maybe we should do something else. The love is there, but through the pain and sadness, sometimes things get a little mixed up.
Is there something from the production that you can share with us?
There is a scene where Walter has gotten drunk one night, and he comes back home, and he has a conversation with Benita, his sister's date. And the outcome of that has left him in a tizzy, and now Ruth is trying to aid and console him from that conversation. Walter Lee, why don't we just try to talk about it?
I've been talking with people who understand me. People who care about the things I got on my mind.
I guess that means people like Willie Harris.
Yes, people like Willie Harris.
Well, why don't you all just hurry up and go into the banking business and stop talking about it?
Why? You want to know why? Because we all tied up in a race of people that don't know how to do nothing but moan, pray, and have babies.
Oh, Walter. Honey, why can't you stop fighting me?
Who's fighting you? Who even cares about you?
Well, I guess I might as well go on to bed then. I don't know where we lost it, Walter, but we have. I'm sorry about this new baby, Walter. I guess I better go on and do what I started. I guess I just didn't realize how things have gotten so bad between us. I guess I just didn't realize.
Wow. And tell me, who else is in the cast?
Our lead is legendary New Orleans icon in stage, film, and theater, Carol Sutton. We have Ebony Johnson, who plays Walter Lee's sister, Benita. We also have Martin Batts Bradford, Christopher Robinson, Jim Holmes, Tracy Mann, and we're introducing Ellington Benoit Tipton.
Now, Lorraine Hansberry, had she lived, would be in her late 80s today.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think she would react to the play's successes decades later and to the state of the American dream for the underserved and disenfranchised today?
You know something? She had a drive and she had a vision that was so huge at that time. I don't think she would be surprised that it would become an American icon. I think she would be surprised that we are where we are today, where we were 60 years ago. But this is America that still dreams. And as Langston Hughes says, what happens to a dream deferred? It all depends on who plants the seed.
Director Tomi Myrick and actors Michael Forrest and Constance Thompson, thanks for stopping by.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Voices in the Dark Repertory Theater Company and Ashe Cultural Arts Center present Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun. Performances run March 15th through 31st at the Ashe Para House, 1731 Barone Street. More info is on the calendar at Ashe, ASHECAC.org. Well, the wait is over. The story of America's founding father, Hamilton, opens at the Sanger. WWNO's Carl Lengel gets a unique perspective on Lin-Manuel Miranda's masterwork through the eyes of an award-winning lighting designer.
The smash hit opened on Broadway in 2015 and garnered 11 Tony Award wins, second only to The Producers with 12 in 2001. It established Lin-Manuel Miranda as an extraordinary force in contemporary entertainment. One of the Tonys went to Howell Binkley for lighting design. I talked with Howell recently about the show. Binkley, originally from North Carolina, has worked his way up in the business over a couple of decades. We started with his humble beginnings in New York, working as the designer for John Houseman's The Acting Company. Hey, Howell, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Carl. It's great to hear your voice.
Wanted to kind of go back into your past and find out how you got started in lighting design.
Yeah, well, I attempted to go to college, and after 3.5 years, I went to New York, and my first job in New York was working with the John Houseman Acting Company. So what they would do is they would tour across the country, internationally as well, but with like three or four shows in repertory. So that was kind of my breakthrough into starting to work in New York theater.
And then you put your nose to the grindstone, got a lot of shows in succession, and worked your way up to a couple of Tony nominations eventually.
My first big break was Kiss of the Spider Woman with Hal Prince. And then that kind of gave me a Broadway exposure. And then I was fortunate enough to work with Kevin McCollum, a producer on several shows, who also produced In the Heights, which was my introduction to Lin-Manuel and to Tommy Cahill, the director.
You build relationships in a production. It seems like that's helped carry you along into Hamilton.
It's a great chemistry that develops through that course of, you know, formatting through a show and putting one up, especially when it's new material, which I just love working on, and so does Tommy and so does Lin, you know, really establishing new material, seeing how it's going to work, how it's going to not work, and, you know, working around the way it doesn't work to make it work.
So there's an advantage because many people may not be aware, but Hamilton was not an overnight success, nor was In the Heights. These shows both workshopped for quite a while and then started, I believe, at the Public Theater in New York?
That's correct, yeah. We went through many, many workshops before we even got to the Public. You know, I mean, the show even had a book at one point, and it ran about 5 hours just in a workshop situation. So, you know, there were many barriers that we all had to cross and learn about through the course of Hamilton. So, and that's what really made it so much fun and exciting, because each level we took it to, we all learned something, and the show was able to grow and prosper.
Can you kind of share some of the things that you got to do in Hamilton that you'd been maybe experimenting with and had thought about before, but this was the first show that the creative staff said, run with this?
Well, I think one great thing about Hamilton that it's just the environment of the show and what the show is about. It's just great choreography, and I love doing dance work. And Andy Blankenbuehler's choreography was just, you know, so storytelling throughout Hamilton. And being able to be able to light dance on such a great set, too, was I was very fortunate to be able to have that real estate to be able to get low side light in and that sort of thing to really sculpt the bodies in a unique way through the course of the show. And just being able to tell the story in that environment as well. There's not a lot of scenery in the show. It's really just one set through the whole thing. It was up to me to carve in areas and lay out places that would establish locations. So that was very challenging for me, but also having great resources of real estate to be able to put lights in great places to be able to do that.
Was there a number that really stood out for you as a challenge or a lot of fun?
Well, I think the battle of scenes and that were very exciting and fun to do. For the audience members, very exciting as well. And that was our job, you know, to make this piece exciting and with all the storytelling that's going on within the music and the movement and being able to thread from song to song, because there's really no, it's all sung. So being able to thread from one song into the next was a huge challenge for all of us.
In fairness to you, this was 5 years ago that you were dealing with this. I know you keep up on the tours and what's going on with the Broadway production and future productions. But you've already done 5 new shows at least since then, and you're currently working on what?
I'm currently doing a new show that just is in previews right now on Broadway called Ain't Too Proud, and it's about the life of the Temptations. You know how they got started? You know, and the music's the music. We all know that.
And in, again, an acknowledgement to your past, you're a Tony winner for Jersey Boys, so this is just a little step to the side in the 60s.
Absolutely.
Howell, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Carl, and it's great talking to you always.
You too. Tony Award-winning lighting designer Howell Binkley. Performances of Hamilton run through March 31st at the Sanger Theater. For Inside the Arts, I'm Carl Lengel.
You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. A few years before his death in 1990, great saxophonist Dexter Gordon started making notes for an autobiography and exacted a promise from his wife, Maxine. If he couldn't finish the book, she would. After a 28-year journey, Maxine Gordon has delivered on that promise big time with her critically acclaimed biography and memoir, Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon. WWNO's Fred Gaston has the story.
Maxine Gordon grew up in New York City. Her relationship with jazz started when she was 14.
What we call jazz kids. We were teenagers, and we used to meet on Fridays and listen to LPs because one of our friend's father was a DJ, or more than a DJ, had a morning radio show, Gallagher and O'Brien. It was, you know, the show. And he got a lot of LPs, and we would go over and listen to jazz LPs on Fridays after school. And then we went to Birdland and the Village Vanguard because they had listening sections. In the back of the club, you could go when you were a teenager. So we were very lucky to grow up with that.
Then when she was 15...
I heard Art Blakey's group with Lee Morgan, Wayne Shorter, Bobby Timmons. That was it. You know, then, I mean, I was like, okay, whatever this is it for me. And
Maxine Gordon's professional involvement with music began as a road manager for great arranger and band leader Gil Evans. She met Gil Evans through her friend Anita.
Anita Evans was married to Gil Evans, and we lived in the same building. And he said, you know, I'm putting my big band together and going to go have some gigs on the road. Would you be the road manager? And I was like, well, I never did that. And he was like, well, it's not that hard. So, not to him. So that was my first job for Gil and his big band.
Then she managed a tour of Portugal and Spain for another friend, organist Shirley Scott. Her road manager qualities were prioritized like this by a certain jazz messenger.
What Art Blakey said was she doesn't drink, she doesn't get high, she can carry the money.
She's also hardworking, highly organized, with an eye for detail and a strong sense of responsibility. And it was through a road manager's gig that she met Dexter Gordon, who lived in Europe, mostly Copenhagen, from 1962 through 1976.
I was working for the agent that booked him in Holland, and they sent me to France because it was a threatened train strike. I had to move the band to Copenhagen and go to Italy, go to Germany, go to Copenhagen. So I met Dexter. They were playing in Nancy, France. And what he said to me was, is that the only book you read? Because I studied the train book for Europe. It was a very thick book with all the train schedules. And we didn't have internet and cell phone. So that was how we worked. Then I met him, and we took that long train trip to Copenhagen. I told him, you should come back. You sound great. People don't know, you know, how good you sound. Why don't you come play in New York? And he said, you know, I've been thinking about coming back, but everybody says they don't care about bebop, and it wouldn't work. And I was like, oh, no, people would love to hear you. You know, what do I know? So I was like, oh, you should come back. And he was like, I want to come back. And so then we started working together, and he did come back, and that worked.
Yeah, well, that was a huge success. Really generated a lot of buzz. I remember very well when that was going on.
Well, you know, it was his money, his idea, and we worked on it for 6 months before he came. And then it was going to be like, well, if it works, good, and if it doesn't, you know, I got a house in Copenhagen. But it did work, and so he moved back, and he lived in New York. And then, you know, I was his friend and his manager, and then I married him.
Dexter and Maxine kept the ball rolling through the rest of the 70s and into the early 80s, and began spending time in Cuernavaca, Mexico. It was there in 1983, at his 60th birthday party, that Dexter Gordon announced he was going to take a break, come off the road, and spend as much time as possible in Cuernavaca. It wasn't long after that, though, that Hollywood came calling, pursuing Dexter for the lead in Round Midnight, which he accepted. The film came out in 1986. Dexter Gordon got a Best Actor Oscar nomination in 1987.
It was after the movie and after the nomination for the Oscar. We were living in Cuernavaca, Mexico, and he got an offer to write his autobiography with someone. You know, who would he write it with? And, of course, being Dexter Gordon, he said, oh, I want to write it with James Baldwin. So yes. He called him, and he was like, Jimmy? They want me to write my autobiography, but, you know, you want to do it with me? And he said, oh, that's a great idea. He said, but I'm not feeling well. I have some health issues, so just write it yourself. You don't need me. You can write it. You write music. You play the saxophone. You can write your own book. Don't let them make you write it with somebody. And Dexter said, so then he told the publisher, well, James Baldwin said I could write it myself. So he began to write it, and then at a certain point, he said, well, if I don't finish, promise me you'll finish the book. And, of course, you know, it's kind of the story of my life. Not knowing what that would take, I said, yeah, no problem. He also said, oh, I'm leaving you money to finish college. He said, oh, I'm sure you regret never finishing college, which I did not regret. But I thought, I think he not regret it, but, you know, that he would have liked to have gone, you know, gone to college, but right. He went on the road, which was, he said, his university training.
Well, yeah, I think graduate school, postgraduate.
Yeah, right.
Everything all
Louis Armstrong, you know.
Between Louis Armstrong and Lionel Hampton.
Lionel Hampton, Billy Eckstein.
Yeah, yeah, I mean.
And being around Dizzy, he said Dizzy Gillespie was the Albert Einstein of modern music.
After Dexter Gordon passed away in April 1990, Maxine Gordon set out on what became a 28-year saga through interviews, archives, libraries, 5 years of writing, to expand Dexter's notes into the now critically acclaimed biography and memoir, Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon, which got a rave review in the New York Times from writer David Haydu.
He came to one of my talks in New York, and I said, when I got texts and emails on that Sunday, they said, oh my God, you know, David Haydu reviewed your book, and I was very nervous because usually when he writes a review, you know, he might say nice things, but at the end he says, however.
Right. On the other hand, right.
On the other hand. But he didn't do that, so I asked him, what happened? You didn't do the however thing, and he was like, well, I tried, but I couldn't find anything I didn't like.
Maxine Gordon also got the seal of approval from two of the great artists she interviewed for the book, saxophonist Sonny Rollins and Jimmy Heath.
He and Sonny Rollins said the same thing to me, get it right. Nobody gets it right. You know, they're not happy with many jazz biographies. So, and then Sonny said, yeah, you got it right.
And as for Jimmy Heath.
And I saw him recently at the Blue Note, and he said, well, I had to live a long time. It took her so long to finish the book, and I wanted to read it. I was like, well, then you can thank me that you live long enough to read the book.
The book is Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon. I'll be interviewing Maxine Gordon about Sophisticated Giant Thursday evening, March 14th, 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Caston.
That's our show for this week. Major support for Inside the Arts comes from the Hellas Foundation. Additional support comes from Christwood Retirement Community, the Contemporary Arts Center, and the New Orleans Opera Association. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette on Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m., and a shortened edition on Thursday mornings at 8:45 when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.